The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 350, Can This Marriage Be Saved? A Therapist's Constructive Suggestions for Healing the Church Intellectual Rift by Mark Koltko.
This is a paper that's by Mark Koltko, Can This Marriage Be Saved? A Therapist's Constructive Suggestions for Healing the Church Intellect Rift. And Mark will be the presenter for this paper, and he will be followed by Lou Chandler. And Lou Chandler currently owns and operates a meeting production firm specialized in business theater. Previously, she has managed the advertising and promotion department for SMS, a Fortune 500 corporation headquartered in Philadelphia. Earlier in her career, she owned and operated Chandler Advertising and Public Relations and managed the Drought Center for the state of Utah during the drought crisis of 1977. And with that, we'll go ahead and start with Mark and turn the time over to him. If you have any questions toward in the question and answer period, be sure to ask it fairly loud, and Mark will and Lou will answer it and repeat it into the microphone so we can get it all on tape. Mark?
I'd like you to eavesdrop on me while I work as a therapist with a troubled couple. For quite some time, I've listened to each member of this couple talking to me and to, or really at, each other. In this chair sits one member of this couple in pain, the church leadership. In this couple sits the other member, that motley group known as the Mormon intellectual community. Having listened for a long while, I'm now ready to make some observations. As I often do when I counsel with a couple, I'll address 4 points. First, I'll briefly describe how they have treated each other. Second, I'll speak about the underlying reasons for that behavior. Third, I'll sketch the outline of a bleak future that I think will grow out of the current situation if it is left unremedied. Fourth, and perhaps most important, I will make concrete suggestions to save this rocky marriage. You're going like this. You can't... That better?
Yeah.
Terrific. First, dealing with the issue, when it comes to describe what each person in this couple has done to the other, we can be brief because this has already been described in great detail elsewhere. Turning to the church, it is evident that some members of the leadership have punished the messenger for the message by excommunicating scholars whose views have troubled the leadership. Why were these troubling issues? Perhaps because the facts were true but did not support the party line. Perhaps the scholars' ideas were controversial, which is to say these ideas could provoke thought in unfamiliar directions. Some church leaders have vilified intellectuals with whom they did not agree and called them bad scholars, when in fact the leaders were just trying to get rid of disturbing scholarship. Some church leaders have also been singularly defensive, describing intellectuals as among the greatest dangers to the church, as apostates who persecute the faithful, and as heretics who strive to lead the innocent astray. Yet the intellectual community bears its own share of responsibility for the difficulties in this relationship. Some scholars have adopted a strident tone that borders on that of the demagogue. Some have used language that seems designed for angry confrontation rather than for true dialogue. Some intellectuals have been glad to vilify church leaders right back. We could spend a lot of time specifying examples, but I would rather focus on why we have these problems and on what we can do about them. So let's focus on why this couple has these problems. I'll focus first on the church. I've noted that some church leaders have dealt with scholars by punishing the messenger, vilification, and defensiveness. Much as these behaviors are destructive, there are reasons for them. I shall focus on two: the ostrich principle and the early trauma of Mormonism. The ostrich principle is not about scholars. It's a way of dealing with ideas. As we shall discuss later, Mormon doctrine and history are not simple. There are complexities, ambiguities, and issues that are confusing and even disturbing. There are different ways of dealing with these disturbing complexities. One popular approach in the church today is to implement the ostrich principle. This principle states that inconvenient difficulties regarding our history or doctrine will go away if we just ignore them and bury our heads in the sand. This is an approach of denial and fear. It reminds me of the motto of a government agency mentioned in George Orwell's novel 1984. In the novel, the government agency in charge of public relations is called the Ministry of Truth, and it has a revealing motto: ignorance is strength. I'm sure that no church leader consciously believes this, but many events in recent years seem to exemplify this motto, which is in direct opposition to the principle that the glory of God is intelligence. But this all begs the question, why do some church leaders follow the ostrich principle? The answer to that is found, I think, in church history, or what I call the trauma of Mormonism's history and adolescence. In a presentation last spring at the Washington, D.C. Sunstone Symposium, I discussed a psychological analysis of church history. I will not recapitulate that paper here. Indeed, I'd like to present it here next year. But I will point out a few issues that are discussed there in more detail. The guiding worldview of some contemporary church leaders was formed at a time when the memory of the violent anti-Mormon persecutions of the 19th century was quite fresh. The late President Benson learned to walk before the Wright brothers learned to fly. It is only with President Hunter that we have a prophet who was born during the 20th century. The dinner table conversation that took place during the wonder years of now senior church leaders may have focused a great deal, I think, on the violent persecutions and government harassments of the 19th century and the political persecutions of the early 20th century. That was a world where anti-Mormon attitudes were so prevalent and so threatening that it truly was necessary to get the wagons in a circle. It was necessary to act with unquestioning unity in the face of sometimes lethal opposition. That was not a time to deal with nuance, ambiguity, or complexity. It was a time to treat things like history and doctrine in a simple, even in a simplistic way, hence the ostrich principle. What's wrong with the ostrich principle now? It doesn't work anymore. We live on the cusp of the 21st century, not on the tail end of the 19th. In earlier days, it was possible to conceal or ignore the complexities of Mormon doctrine and history. But now, in an era of photocopiers and email, it is impossible to conceal these complexities. And in an age of widespread education among Mormons, we cannot expect thinking saints to ignore the more difficult questions. But more about that later. Having discussed why the church has behaved as it has, I would like to turn to the intellectuals. I've pointed out that some intellectuals have contributed to the difficulties in the relationship with the church leadership by adopting strident and confrontational tones. Here, too, there are reasons for this behavior, reasons that I call the dark side legacy of the 60s. Most of the scholars and intellectuals involved in the recent painful debates and excommunications could legitimately be called children of the 60s. The 1960s had many lessons to teach, for good and for ill. Among the positive lessons of the 60s that were the following. It can be liberating to look at new ideas. We have important things to learn from different cultures and traditions. People can create their own lifestyles, and the pursuit of worldly wealth is ultimately empty. But there were darker lessons from the 60s as well, negative and one-sided lessons. The politics of the 60s was largely a politics of protest, confrontation, and polarization, a politics of us versus a more powerful them. Social issues were settled by picket sign and shout, rifle and tear gas, on occasion by indictment, trial, imprisonment, forced resignations, even assassinations. It can be argued that in the 60s, in the American nation, progress could not have been achieved without confrontation. But I doubt that this is a good model to use in working out our difficulties in Mormon society in the 90s. I am reminded of an incident mentioned in the autobiography of Elder Hugh B. Brown. In this autobiography, published posthumously, Elder Brown noted that there was a time in the 1960s when President David O. McKay seriously considered a change in the priesthood policy that would have extended the priesthood to all worthy males regardless of ancestry. However, President McKay was antagonized by strident protesters at that time and took the position that he would not appear before the world to be forced into anything by anyone. He would not be backed into a corner and made to respond. The result of this was a delay in the change of the priesthood policy for almost a generation. I find it of interest that the priesthood policy was changed precisely when confrontations about the racial policies of the church were at a record low. The lesson to learn from this is that the confrontational tactics of the 1960s may not work well with a leadership whose responses reflect the anti-Mormon world of the 1920s and earlier. Unfortunately, this is a lesson that some Mormon intellectuals have yet to learn. I would like to turn to a description of what I think is at risk if the current tensions between these two, the church leadership and the intellectual community, continues unabated. In the short term, I see the possibility for a civil war between the hierarchies and the scholars. In the long term, I see the saints weakened and Mormonism diminished as a world force. Let's talk about the short term in the Mormon Civil War. In two recent books, the sociologist James Davison Hunter has charted the way in which cultural conflicts occur in the United States today. Especially in his most recent book, Before the Shooting Starts, Mr. Hunter points out that the sequence of events seems to involve an increasing polarization in debate, mutual vilification, and the strengthening of an us-versus-them mentality on both sides. Sound familiar? Wait, it gets better. Mr. Hunter points out that in the mid-19th century, this kind of conflict and the breakdown of discussion about social and philosophical issues led to the Civil War, the bloodiest conflict that the United States has ever seen. In our day, this kind of conflict has been seen in the abortion conflict, which has some signs of developing into a literal shooting war. What relevance does this have for Mormonism? If current trends continue, we will see the discussion between leader and scholar become more polarized, the name-calling more intense, the conflict more vituperative, until the ecclesiastical equivalent of war occurs, with the mass silencing of Mormon intellectuals through intimidation and excommunication. In the short run, the loss would be most apparent among intellectuals, who would lose access to the communion of the saints and the saving ordinances. But the long term would be a disaster for the church as a whole. What would happen to a Mormonism without its intellectuals? I think that it would become much weaker, losing its opportunity to become a global religion. Thank you very much. To understand why this is so, it is necessary to look at what productive role intellectuals play in the church. I've mentioned before that Mormon history and doctrine have complications. I'm not talking about esoteric, obscure points, but rather I mean issues which go to the very core of Mormonism. I mean issues like the nature of prophecy and revelation, priesthood, godhood, human life and society. For example, Joseph Smith's understanding of doctrine may have been informed by an acquaintance with the Kabbalah, which is to say the Jewish mystical tradition, as well as Gnosticism and the Hermetic tradition. What does this say about the way in which doctrine develops, or about the nature of prophecy? As another example, what did Joseph Smith really organize amongst women in the 1840s, and what implications does that have today for men, women, and priesthood? Entirely apart from doctrine and history, the areas of practice and lifestyle bring up questions. Are we responding appropriately as a church to the phenomenon of sexual abuse? What kind of dynamics exist in the church as an organization and as a leadership structure? And how do these dynamics help and hinder the spiritual mission of the church? How does the American culture of the church help and hinder missionary work throughout the world? You might think that these issues are relatively high-level doctrinal, historical, and social matters that would mean little to converts found among the agrarian peoples or the urban poor of South America, Asia, and Africa. That may be true in this generation. But one well-established fact about Mormonism is that it brings people to education. As Armand Maus has pointed out in his recent book, The Angel and the Beehive, the Mormon focus on education has created a substantial grassroots intellectualism throughout the American church. Within one or two generations, I feel that education will create a large mass of intellectually oriented people in the international church. People who will seek for a deeper understanding of their history and doctrine. People who will seek to grapple with more difficult and ambiguous issues. Perhaps this is inevitable among people who believe that the glory of God is intelligence, and who are commanded to serve God with all their heart, might, mind, and strength. As it is happening today in the central stakes of Zion, so it will happen tomorrow in Nigeria, Brazil, Thailand, Tibet. There are other reasons than just Mormon doctrine for this to happen, and this point is crucial. A maturing religious civilization naturally becomes more intellectually inclined. This is explicit or implicit in the theories of cultural and personal development constructed by such eminent psychologists as Abraham Maslow, Lawrence Kohlberg, and James Fowler. In brief, these theories state that eventually people can mature to the point where they must feel intellectually honest about their faith. As people mature intellectually, they will seek to deal with questions like those I've just described. These are not questions that one will find discussed at BYU Education Week. They were, however, discussed yesterday in this symposium. Without a group of loyal intellectuals in the church, the intellectually curious, educated converts and their descendants will be faced with no one with whom to discuss their questions. We are likely to see among them what other religious organizations have seen when they could not offer intellectual food to their membership: boredom, restlessness, an openness to defection to other groups. Mormonism could become marginalized, diminished, doomed to extinction as an intellectual force in the world. We would continue on the earth to await the Savior, but our influence in the world would be smaller than it is even today. Yet intellectuals are not just important as a sort of internal nourishment to the church. There are external threats to the church as well, and intellectuals can be an important defense for Mormonism. I've already alluded to complexities regarding our doctrine and history. There are enemies of our people who seek to use these to drive people away from the church and the gospel. Our scholars and intellectuals are largely trying to deal with these complexities within a context of belief. If we hobble these scholars with disciplinary actions, we permit others to interpret our history within a hostile context of unbelief. We would abandon the field to our enemies, the anti-Mormon bigots of the world, and they are truly legion. In sum, this is possibly the most important thing I've had to say so far. We have to give up the idea that by simply not paying attention to social issues and hard questions of doctrine, history, and practice, that they will just go away. If we pretend we can ignore these matters, we are dooming Mormonism to a sort of intellectual extinction, as people look to other paradigms than the gospel to answer their question. Don't let the number of convert baptisms lead you into a false sense of security. Eventually, a religious civilization rises to a place where it must feel intellectually honest about its religion. This can take generations, but it is already happening in the central stakes of Zion, and it will happen inevitably throughout the world. When I work with couples, at about this point, both members of the couple are thinking that they really want to avoid the bleak picture that I've just painted. They're a bit more open to change. I believe that, at heart, the church leadership and Mormon scholars both want to save this marriage. So I would like to turn now to a consideration of what the church leadership and Mormon scholars could do to avert the unhappy possible future I've outlined. I make suggestions like those I'd make to any couple in conflict, which include the following general ideas that I will discuss in more detail. First, respect the validity of each other's point of view. Second, be true to one another. Third, accept your responsibilities. And fourth, agree on how to raise the children. Let's start off with respecting the validity of each other's point of view. And I'll speak first to the church side of the issue. One would show that one respects this validity by accepting the necessity to ask certain questions. Church leaders need to recognize that it's necessary for many mature people to ask questions, searching, penetrating, even disturbing questions. This is not a frill. For many mature people, it's a psychological necessity to pursue investigations that call into question even our most basic assumptions. It's been very gratifying to me to see that at least some church leaders understand that this type of questioning is part of the development of a mature spirituality. I will quote now from a talk given by a current church leader that illustrates this understanding. I quote, "We have more respect for one who honestly doubts than for one who fears to declare loyalty. Thomas doubted. He traveled the path from faith through the valley of doubt to new heights of faith. This is the course that many follow in life. As children, we accepted as fact the things which were told to us by our parents or our teachers because of the confidence that we had in them. As children grow older, they commence to think for themselves, to question and have doubts about those things which are not subject to tangible proof. I have sympathy for men and women when honest doubts enter their minds and they engage in the great conflict of resolving doubts. These doubts can be resolved if they have an honest desire to know the truth by exercising moral, spiritual, and mental effort. They will emerge from the conflict into a firmer, stronger, larger faith because of the struggle. They have gone from a simple, trusting faith through doubts and conflicts into a solid, substantial faith which ripens into testimony." End quote. These are the words of someone who understands that truth has nothing to fear, that faith is not weakened by questioning if that questioning is allowed to proceed forward unfettered as far as it needs to go. This is someone who agrees with Thomas Jefferson that it is an insult to religion to suppose that it cannot stand the test of truth and reason. I'm glad to see that someone in the church hierarchy understands these principles. I'm delighted to find that this particular someone was set apart as the prophet and president of the church less than 3 months ago. I was quoting, of course, from a general conference address made by Elder Howard W. Hunter 1 year after he was first sustained as a member of the Council of the Twelve. I trust that the passage of time has not dimmed his commitment to these principles. How could the church demonstrate, in practical terms, that it accepts the necessity to ask piercing questions by doing something we already try to do, by training? Church leaders can make a focus of training in this issue at all levels of the church, from the ward teacher development courses right up through church educational system policy statements. Church leaders can make this a focus of training for bishops and stake presidents. The leadership can speak of it from the pulpit as President Hunter did over 30 years ago. It can be done if, as a church, we have the will. When I get to this point in a meeting with a couple, I often remember that old light bulb joke. How many counselors does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. I'd like to turn now to the intellectuals and how it is that they might show respect for the validity of the point of view of the other party in the couple. My first sub-suggestion, accept the miraculous. There is an odd symmetry between the church and the intellectuals. Some church leaders act as if the miraculous nature of the church makes it unnecessary to consider mundane explanations for its history. On the other hand, some intellectuals act as if mundane explanations were sufficient. It has become fashionable among a minority within the LDS intellectual community to reject out of hand the possibility of anything truly miraculous within church history, to ignore the idea of any literal fulfillment of prophecy as some kind of embarrassment. I exhort you to reconsider your roots. The God of Mormonism is indeed a God of miracles, prophecy, revelation, and spiritual gifts. It is indeed a mistake to write history as if every off-the-cuff remark of Joseph Smith's were an inspired utterance, but it is equally a mistake to write as if there were no such thing as an inspired utterance. My second sub-suggestion to the intellectual community, cease to antagonize. No one, including the general authorities, likes to feel that they're being backed into a corner. Don't put the GAs into the position of having to win or lose by creating confrontational situations or using the rhetoric of the protest march. Cease from name-calling. Yes, I know, we're called names. We are called cruel, unjust names. But as I recall, we take our example from one who permitted himself to be scourged and nailed to a rude cross without complaint. I think we can put up with a little name-calling. Not long ago, an intellectual published a plea to the leadership of the church titled, Choose Love, Not Power. A similar plea to intellectuals might be titled, Choose Love, Not Confrontation. It is harder to believe that love will work, but being a Latter-day Saint was never meant to be easy. So what shall we do instead of antagonize? In our writings and discussions, in our communications with authorities, we should appeal to the central values of Mormonism. We could quote things like the pro-intellectual statements of Joseph Smith, and in doing this, we'll demonstrate that what we do from a love of this gospel and not any other. We should assume, it's a charitable assumption, but we should assume that the leadership of the church want at heart to uphold these same values. Assume good motives, and you help to create them. This is empathy and compassion. Like the flower campaign and the olive branch statement, we should focus on demonstrating persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness and meekness and love unfeigned, that they may know that our faithfulness is stronger than the cords of death. Turning to a consideration to be true to each other, I'll speak first to the church, and in this case at some length. The church could show that it wishes to be true to the other member in the couple by decriminalizing intellectualism. The church has an obligation to nurture its intellectual members in their honest search for the truth, even when that search leads them to ask questions or come to conclusions that others find unsettling. The church should decriminalize intellectual discourse. And there are two things it could do to do this, to implement this strategy. Discern and discriminate. By discern, I mean that church leaders need to learn how to discern between well-intentioned scholarship that disagrees with a mainstream interpretation on the one hand and apostasy on the other. Merely recognizing that such a distinction exists would be a tremendous improvement over what we have now. An alternative method of faithfully interpreting events is not an attack, not even on orthodoxy. But what does apostasy mean in a Mormon context? Well, it would seem that the Lord would have us define no dogmas. Consequently, we cannot use simple adherence to a given doctrinal interpretation to define apostasy. I realize that this perspective requires a major adjustment in the thinking of some saints, but it seems to be the only consistent approach given our belief in an open theology. Joseph Smith seemed to use the same approach. I quote from a sermon in April Conference in 1843. Elder Pelletiah Brown has been preaching concerning one of the figures in the book of Revelation, and for this he was hauled up for trial before the High Council. I did not like the old man being called up for erring in doctrine. It looks too much like the Methodist, and not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. It does not prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine. End of quote. So what is apostasy then? The dictionary defines it as renunciation of a religious faith, abandonment of a previous loyalty, or defection. Thus, one may appropriately name as apostate those who join other religious organizations or who explicitly state that they do not believe in the doctrines of the LDS scriptures in any form. Note that people can understand the scriptures differently and not be apostate. Apostasy should also be considered an appropriate label for those who have the explicit agenda of working against the mission of the church, such as interfering with missionary programs, or those who attempt to proselytize saints to other religious organizations. Now, I've talked about discernment. Let me now talk about discrimination. By discriminate, I mean a verb that means to compartmentalize. I suggest that the church create mental compartments in terms of how it treats ideas depending on the context in which these ideas appear. Scholarly publication or discussion should be treated completely differently from preaching or teaching in church meetings. Publications in scholarly journals or thought-provoking magazines, presentations made at intellectually oriented symposia, all of this is the lifeblood of intellectual discourse, and the church does no one a favor by infringing on this area, least of all itself. Now, in terms of being true to one another, I'd now like to speak to the intellectuals, and I have one particular piece of advice, brief but strong. Stick by the church. I was grieved to learn of last year's excommunications, but I was just as pained to hear of the voluntary withdrawals from membership that some people have made. There's an old Jewish saying in the Talmud, "It is not given to you to complete the work, but it is not granted to you to give it up either." The family of Zion may be dysfunctional, but that dysfunction does not release me from my obligation to build it up and establish it. Now I'll turn to the major idea of accepting your responsibilities as I turn to this couple. In terms of the church can show this by fulfilling the responsibilities that they have to the membership to deal honestly with questions. If church leaders have such serious differences with a scholar's interpretation of history or doctrine, they should engage the issues involved, argue with the facts, not the person, come up with a better interpretation of the history or doctrine involved. If we agree with the proposition that scholarly disagreements are not apostate, then they should be settled by scholarly discourse and not by disciplinary councils to start off with. This may be news to some people, but listen up, folks. Especially this fellow down, I'm sure, on South Temple who's going to be listening to this tape. Oh, and I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome our unseen audience this afternoon. This may be news to you, but listen up here. No thoughtful person believes that a disciplinary council establishes the truth or falsehood of an idea. The church has at its disposal one of the largest private universities in the United States. If that university is doing what it should be doing in attracting a bright, committed, able faculty, there should be no shortage of professors who can correct whatever mistaken interpretation some other scholar comes up with. If this isn't a way for BYU to earn its keep, I don't know what is. For intellectuals, in terms of fulfilling their responsibilities, those fall into three complementary categories for which I have sub-suggestions: responsibilities to the Lord, to the church, and to the intellectual community. First sub-suggestion, develop your spirituality. It behooves intellectuals to focus on their spiritual development through prayer, meditation, and contemplative study. This will keep us humble, provide balance to our thought lives, and remind us that there is a spiritual reality that transcends puny power plays, politics, and differences of interpretation. A focus on spirituality will keep us from being puffed up in our learning and will make our learning into something good through hearkening to divine counsel. In this regard, I was humbled and heartened to hear some of the most prominent faithful intellectuals of our day say in a symposium session the day before yesterday that when they teach the gospel doctrine class, they focus on the actual text of the scriptures because we understand it so poorly. None of us will ever be beyond that in this life. Secondly, as a sub-suggestion, fulfill your callings. It behooves intellectuals to be especially assiduous in fulfilling our church callings or in rendering compassionate service. As a third sub-suggestion, continue to be counted. By being counted, I mean that we must not give in to the pressure to not speak or publish on certain topics in a scholarly or intellectual way. I strongly feel that we must make no concessions to censorship. If we're going to expect the church to treat us as scholars and intellectuals, we have to first treat ourselves as such. The founders of this nation noted that eternal vigilance is the price of freedom, and the same can be said for the price of intellectual discourse. When I was preparing to make my first Sunstone Symposium presentation in 1987, a concerned friend who had high-level connections in Salt Lake City, cautioned me against it. She told me it was not a good time to speak up on Mormon issues. But the truth is that, by definition, there is never a good time to differ with mainstream interpretations. We create our own opportunities or we don't get them. I'd now like to turn to the idea for this poor troubled couple. You've got to agree on how to raise the children. Which is to say, I'm going to speak about BYU. Turning to the church must decide whether BYU is going to behave like a real university. BYU is at a fork in the road. If it decides it really wishes to become a world-class university, then it must behave like one and allow few, if any, fetters on intellectual discourse. This would be the Notre Dame-Georgetown-Fordham University type of model. On the other hand, if BYU decides that being a world-class university is less important than upholding a particular very, very narrow orthodoxy in all its teaching, then it has every right to seek to enforce that orthodoxy. This would be the Bob Jones University model. There is a place in the ecology of education for each type, and each is honorable in its own sphere, much the same way that the eagle and the bread mold. Each has its own appropriate niche in nature. However, these types cannot be mixed. At this point, it's unclear which of these mutually exclusive roads the church is going to take. It cannot postpone the decision for long. Various accrediting associations, like the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, right down to the American Psychological Association, will be conducting their periodic reaccreditation shortly. Perhaps more importantly, part of being a world-class university consists of one's reputation for fostering intellectual investigation. The events of the last year have not been and will not be looked upon kindly. BYU's trustees and administrators must make these decisions rather quickly. If it hopes to go the world-class route, BYU must change its attitudes and its policies towards dealing with different interpretations of history and doctrine and towards faculty participation in independent symposia. Turning now to the intellectuals, my first sub-suggestion is interview at BYU on your own terms. It has been suggested that intellectuals abandon BYU completely and let it become an intellectual wasteland. While there may be some wisdom in this course, I would counsel a different approach. Interview at BYU and give them something to ponder about and drool over. When you interview with the Y, if the matters of publishing in Sunstone or Dialogue or attending the symposia are brought up, ask what relevance this has for hiring at BYU. Gently and kindly, but firmly, insist on seeing policies in writing. What a thought! If policy is mentioned, be clear about your intent to publish or present studies of interest to you wherever you find an appropriate forum, and make clear that you are sure that a first-class, world-class university would judge your work on the merits of its content, right? Most importantly, be such a superb scholar that the appropriate department insists on having you. If concerns about academic freedom cause you to decline a position, make that reason clear. Second sub-suggestion, be wise. Be sure to publish in the central journals in your field, both before and after signing on at BYU. Develop an area of expertise outside of Mormon studies. Those who have ears to hear will hear. Note that all of this is in addition to, not instead of, your work in Mormon intellectual studies. Well, the time has come to send our troubled couple out into the world. I hope that they, which is to say, I hope that we, give serious thought to these ideas. What good could come from a change in the relationship between the leadership and the scholars? Such a change is a prerequisite to having Miltons and Shakespeares of our own. Creativity can only flourish in an atmosphere of openness and is crippled by censorship. Such a change in the relationship is necessary to preach the gospel effectively. We need to give people a way to reject the lies of the world for something better than prevarication about our past or our doctrine. Such a change in the relationship is necessary to fulfill our claim that we believe in being honest. When we are honest with scholars, when we are honest as scholars, We affirm our faith and religion. When we do otherwise, we desecrate the holy name. Let us bless it instead by our dedication to the truth. Thank you very kindly.
Well, boy, is that a great sound or what? I am not in the same field as Mark, obviously, and so I'm going to respond to Mark's comments from the standpoint of advertising and public relations and marketing. Now, in the field, in this field, we don't heal the rift, we bridge the gap. And our two disciplines are very different, of course, but quite similar in concept. Now, the role of public communications and advertising and marketing people, the basic role is, or the basic objective is, rather, to change people's minds. That's what we're trying to do. We're changing the mind. It's called positioning. And if we're going to bridge a gap in understanding, it really requires that we bring about a change in the minds of the people that are involved. Okay, now, this tool of positioning that this profession uses has four steps, one of which is determine who is the audience. That's easy in our case. Explore what the audience currently thinks and why they think it. Design a message that's going to convince them. Map out the vehicles for the message. Okay, well, I'm not going to go into detail on that, but the technique in its purest form, I know this is going to be hard to believe, but the technique in its purest form can be a pretty Christ-like endeavor. I mean, think about it. The foundation of it really is it's caring enough about the audience to explore their motivations, to empathize with them enough to imagine how they might react to various ways that we could give a message. And it's caring enough about that message to prepare it and offer it in a way that will render the audience open to consider it. What a concept. I got to say that I am always appalled when I meet up with people who say that they had said something to so-and-so and they said it in a very careful, tactful way and they felt that they were being dishonest to their viewpoint by being tactful. A tactful expression of a viewpoint is not dishonest. It's a kind, loving way and the only effective way to get a message across. Okay, so let's explore for just 1 minute these two audiences. And Mark did this very nicely, but I'm going to summarize a little bit of how I see it. Okay, I can't remember which side they're sitting on, but let's say we've got the general authorities on this side and the intellectuals on this side. Okay. Now, thankfully, there's a lot of diversity among us. A lot of people think there isn't, but there is. And I have great hope that there's diversity among the general authorities, and they all don't think exactly the same way as the one whose initials are BK. Nevertheless, irrespective of that, we need to take a look at collectively what are we like, essentially. Okay, so these guys, the general authorities sitting in this chair, are essentially businessmen. Most of them came from a business background. Now, I'm talking about old-style business. I'm not talking about the TQM methodologies of today. We're talking about old-style business, very hierarchical. Never could say that word right. Very authoritative. Management courses taught in those days how to take charge, how to establish a vision, and how to line up your ducks behind them. On the other hand, on the academic side, we are trained to explore all the options, to get everybody's opinion, to get discourse and discussion going and analysis. And to taking that to its extreme, we get into analysis paralysis and we don't get anything done. But there, it's two different schools of thought. The general authorities value image. Their motivation is to protect tender testimonies, I suppose. And the intellectuals are truth seekers. We value truth above image. Okay. Now, if we're going to seek an understanding of the orientations, well, let me put it this way. Seeking an understanding of the orientation, where they're coming from, and the motivations of the other side of the fence, whichever side it is the only way to develop a tactful message that will effectively bring about understanding and harmony. Now, the one thing that, the only area that I disagree with Mark in is that assuming, the assumption that both groups want to be in this counseling chair. My contention is that at least at this point in time, the responsibility for trying to bring about understanding is more on the side of the intellectuals than it is on the side of the general authorities. That's not fair. But the reality is they aren't motivated to bring about this understanding because they're the ones in the position of authority. And secondly, they're not equipped to bring about this understanding because, let's see, why? Less equipped because of their authoritative business backgrounds. They're not into seeking the middle ground. They're into setting their vision, being decisive, and why aren't you doing what I want you to do? Okay, so they don't have the expertise. They also aren't motivated. Okay, now, I'm just going to summarize with a couple of stories that, frankly, I think if we're going to bring about change in understanding, it happens most effectively at the grassroots level. And I would hope that we would all do, as Mark suggests, and stop biting our tongues in church. But that when we do open our mouths, we do so in a tactful way. And that we do so in a way that will help people to understand where we're coming from. And frankly, when I've had the gumption to do that, I've always been amazed at how many people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I wish I'd said that. You know, people that I would not have thought would have had any thoughts in that direction. It's amazing. Okay, now, what if our efforts to achieve greater understanding, at least in the short term with church leadership, fails? I have a real quick story to tell you that really helped me, and that Some of us in this audience may have been involved in the IWI conference of several years ago. That affected me very deeply, and I had a difficult time going back to church and taking anybody seriously there. And a dear friend of mine told me this story. She had lived in the Oakland area, and when she got there, she and her husband went to some stake activities, and nobody was there. Hardly anybody attended them. And they were lousy, poorly planned, and she couldn't understand this. She'd never experienced this. And so she found out that there were these social clubs in the Oakland area that were only available by invitation. And she had not been invited, largely because they knew they were only going to be temporary there, and a lot of times we don't pay attention to the temporary transient people that come in and out of our wards, and so they left very hurt. Well, it turns out they ended up moving back there, and she had this idea, by darn, I'm going to do something about this, and she managed to get called as the stake activities committee person. I guess you have to be a high councilman for that. She must have been called the cultural arts specialist who does all the work of the... I've been in that position. And she tried very hard to make these worthwhile events. She communicated a great deal to the leadership saying, please support these. And she worked very hard. They were wonderful events, and still nobody came. And she was feeling terrible about it. The stake president wouldn't come. The high councilman wouldn't come. Obviously, their social needs were being filled elsewhere. They didn't need to be there. So she got very discouraged and unhappy about this, and stake conference happened. They said, can you sustain your stake leaders? Everybody raised their hand, but she could not. And it surprised her. And she went to the stake president and said, I'm feeling really, really, really bad about this. And he said, I think you're on the doorstep of apostasy, and you better go home and pray about this. So she did. She went home and fasted and prayed for some time and got no comfort. And then one time she was helping her son go to sleep. And he wouldn't. He was taking his nap, wouldn't go to sleep. So she lay down with him. And she fell asleep instead. And in her dream, she dreamed that she awoke. She looked at her watch and thought, oh, it's time to make dinner. I better hurry. She glanced at the corner of the room, and there she saw the toy shelf, the toy box, the chest of drawers, and the closet door. And then she turned to leave the room to go make dinner. And to her surprise, all she could see was the toy box, the chest of drawers, and the closet door. She shook her head. She closed her eyes, rubbed her eyes, opened her eyes. Every time, all she could see was the toy box, chest of drawers, the closet door. She burst out crying, felt her way down the stairs, sat at the dining room table, still could only see those three things, and railed, if all I can see is one thing, I might just as well be blind. And at that, she woke up and realized that that was the answer for her. Sometimes our answers come in interesting ways, and that story really helped me to put things a little more into perspective. Dr. Bassett, I love what he says in the same vein. Do we understand the role of the church as a catalyst in our development? It seems to me that the church serves a very vital role in the development of wholeness and proper spiritual healthiness. It provides, if it were, a protective semi-protective rehearsal hall for our role in attempting to develop Christ-like attributes. The church, like our families, gives us a chance to practice with others who theoretically have a similar commitment and to talk about what we experience. And then, from this springboard, we should be prepared to carry the experiment further out into the world. We need to note that in the church serves a dual purpose in this process. It is not only a comfort station, nor should it be. It also can become the cross we bear. And we need to anticipate both types of experiences in the church. I recently heard of a woman who stopped attending the church because she felt that it didn't serve any purpose in her life anymore, didn't provide the intellectual stimulus she desired. I suspect that she was thinking of it in the first sense, as a first aid stop. But in reality, the church brings us in contact with people who disappoint us and who constantly rub us the wrong way. I suspect the Lord planned it that way. Our church experience... I missed typing something in here. I suspect the Lord planned it that way, locked as we are in our wards and stakes. The church experience serves a vital role in our practice for the larger world and for our life in an eternal sense. The church places us in close contact with people we might ordinarily avoid in life, and there's no getting away from them. There it is, locked as we are in the same wards. We might even find them presiding over us. Patience with the bishop's mistakes, long-suffering with that Sunday school class, temperance with the seemingly unending demands of church, kindness, charity. It's in the church situation that we get some of the best practice in life regarding what it means to be Christian. It's those two stories that have enabled me to do as Mark has suggested, to stick with it and to be counted. And I hope, as Levi Peterson has said, that if I were excommunicated on a Thursday, that they would find me on a Sunday on the back row asleep in sacrament meeting the very next Sunday. So hopefully that's useful, and we have a little time for questions. Where's our...
Green shirt.
I have a couple questions for you.
Yeah, make them quick. We got 4 minutes. Yeah. No, it isn't. The question is, how do I address people who are intellectuals but who are already, in a sense, embraced in the bosom of the church by virtue of having faculty appointments? The why? I would submit to you that is a fragile embrace, as we've seen recently. I don't really see any need to. There is not really tenure at BYU in the usual sense. My suggestions are really the same. I think that BYU professors, when they speak out of a very narrow interpretation of doctrine, are considered suspect, and as we've seen in the last couple of years, they're certainly considered expendable. So you had a second question, I think? Quickly? Yeah? Okay. The question is, I've said that scholars are trying to work within a discussion of belief, and you attending the symposium have seen presentations where that isn't the case. I didn't say that all scholars or all intellectuals work within a context of belief. I've said that a lot do, and I certainly think most do. But it's in the nature of any kind of intellectual discourse that everybody that it's a really heterogeneous and motley group. Some will and some won't, and that's the price you pay for being in that game at all. You've had a question, ma'am? Yeah? Uh-huh. Okay, the question is, one half of the marriage couple is not present, so to speak, in this presentation. How do we deal with that? Let me tell you, in fact, that I know that a tape of this presentation will, in fact, go on an official basis to be under review in the church office building. And I also have it on very good authority that a lot of the remarks made at Sunstone do circulate on an unofficial basis, even to very high levels of the church hierarchy. Hi, gang. So I'm not too worried about it. Okay? Yes? Very, very quick question. We have seconds. Yes. How can a rapprochement occur if both sides... It can't. I will say, though, that we need to make the assumption of goodwill or we will create polarization. This is a shift for us. Okay? We need to assume that both sides really want to be honest. I'll be glad to stay afterwards to discuss other questions, but I'm afraid the session has to conclude now. Thank you.
We thank Mark and Lou for presenting these papers, and tapes are available of the session if you want to listen to it more. Thank you.